Has that actually happened to you or one of your co-stars where you'll be doing a scene and then suddenly like they're hungry and you hear a gurgle or no?
It just happened to me just now.
Oh.
Faden? Cut to.
Exterior. Interior.
Restaurant.
Bar. Club.
Day.
Night.
Action!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Restaurant Fiction, where we record in sunshiny Los Angeles, right on Pacific Coast Highway. Obviously, we have the ocean in back of me anyway. This is Restaurant Fiction once again. My name is Manas Rose, where we explore the fictional restaurants, bars, and clubs in TV and film. Today's episode is none other than amazing actor and improv comedian Mark Evan Jackson. You know him from Lessons in Chemistry. You know him from The Good Place. He specialized in The Bad Place. You know him from a slew of other films and TV projects. He's came on to break down Lessons in Chemistry, Supper at Six, and just explore. And we just are going to do a deep dive of how awesome and amazing Mark Evan Jackson is in general. Enjoy. All right. Mark, listeners, audience out there, we dined at Supper at Six. You see, this is a cooking show that serves, obviously, food to where you don't just wing it. The food, the R&D process is not about just winging it and feeling it. No, the TLC that goes into this food, you could pretty much write a chemistry PhD thesis on. You know, cooking shows that we are brought up with around this time of Supper at Six are like, say, the Julia Child, you know, where she made French cuisine a little more comfortable for Americans. There was also The Joy of Cooking, which kind of was like a textbook 101 to release any kind of fears you have with the kitchen. With Supper at Six, it's very much more empowering. It's empowering and it's saying, hey, not just cooking is cool, but you're cool. So live your original cool life. It's almost like a hoorah, but intrinsically, not just extrinsically. But, you know, even if Supper at Six goes off the air, there's always going to be a few different dishes that linger. Number one, let's break it down, is the lasagna. The lasagna, you know, it's not just meat, cheese, and noodles. I mean, the ricotta bechamel is ungodly, heavenly, and just from another world. I mean, in a way, what it does is it makes wearing sweatpants at a Michelin star restaurant acceptable. Like really, that is the feel you get. The chicken pot pie is the Mona Lisa of pot pies, of any kind of savory pie, because you feel beyond the flaky crust that every single morsel of the pea, the carrot, the chicken chunk was carefully placed and well balanced. Then there's the oyster zot, which we actually really admired because Oysters Rockefeller just seems snooty. It seems like we're going to an old man's steakhouse, and oyster zot is adventurous. It's light. It's like, I can eat this. I can get behind this dish. And finally is the almost the school lunchbox type chocolate and peanut butter brownies. You know, you think that these two flavors should be separated, but no, it is world peace in a dish. And it's like if a brownie could exemplify, I wish, world, not just U.S. politics, but world politics, I mean, this does, because both of these flavors just get along swimmingly. You know, Emeril Lagasse, he pretty much helped start the Food Network, and he did bam, he went off the cuff and went bam to add to food. You know, Supper at Six doesn't really need any of that pizzazz to really add that umami, that je ne sais quoi, if you will. I think I'm mispronouncing that word, you know. So is eating any of the food or the experience of supper at six, is it, say, sinful or heavenly? You know, are you going to go to the good place or the bad place? Well, personally, for Restaurant Fiction, we just say, enjoy the ride, and then tomorrow, eat a salad and go for a good erg. So we are talking to actor, comedian, amazing person, Mark Evan Jackson, who had a hand in Lessons in Chemistry. He played Dr. Mason in Lessons in Chemistry. Mark, what did you think of that review? The floor is yours. What is your opinion on that?
I think you're asking an awful lot of a brownie to solve world peace, but I think that the creators of Lessons in Chemistry would love to know that anybody has spent this much time thinking about the ins and outs of the food presented in the show. I love the presentation of Elizabeth Zott as a chemist doing this. It's as you say, it's got a little bit of Julia Child in it. It's got a little bit of Hidden Figures. This was set in a time where you know, women had to find their voice in society. They you know, were often housewives and thought of secondarily. And so it's an empowering story that I think the food is really a vehicle for. And I do love that she's a chemist because I think a lot of love goes into it, but also it's a formulaic thing. She, Elizabeth Bree's character, Elizabeth Zott, doesn't have a lot of, you know, she's not beholden to French history or cooking history or, you know, how her mother did it or whatever. She's going to find the best way, the best temperature, the best duration to cook a certain thing. And it's a formula. It's a recipe. It's an experiment.
Obviously, your character, Dr. Mason, is not heavily involved in the food scenes. And we'll get to your character is involved in very important scenes, but not, say, food scenes. But still, what foods do you envision Dr. Mason loving and eating?
I've thought about this not at all. But because he's an athlete, because he's a rower, I would think that he would have a pretty substantial carbohydrate need. So I could see him, you know, eating pasta the night before an early morning row or that sort of thing. He seems fairly East Coasty. I bet he loves a chowder. That's not something that I would have given much thought to.
But what kind of thought, you know, because your character is an OBGYN and, you know, I mean, but anyway, you know, what kind of, say, research or even story in your own mind did you bring to your character?
Oh. Is none a bad answer? I wouldn't have researched being an OBGYN. I think as an actor, you look for clues in the script. You look for the hints that the writers have given you about your point of view, and then it's up to you to decide what kind of day that person's having, where they were just before that moment that we're choosing to televise. What they're looking for or afraid of after that moment. Those are the little bits of sauce that an actor gets to bring to a role. But yes, I did not go to medical school to play Mason.
Yeah, I don't think Brie when got her PhD from MIT or.
I mean, I didn't ask her. It's possible. Brie is a different brand of actor than I am. Yeah, she's the real thing.
One of your character's most pivotal scenes with Elizabeth is pretty much a scene where you come in to do a house call and you pretty much say for her, hey, I got an extra spot to erg, to be on my erg team. And basically, you're telling her, hey, do some self-love. Do some self-care, some self-love for yourself. Even if, yes, you have the stresses of life weighing down astronomically on your soul, but still you have self-love. Like, what is, in your own life, what is your erg? What is your get out your self-love, your self-care?
I mean, erging is, I do row. Long before I was had this role, I had a rowing machine at home and would work out on that. I should talk about learning to row for this show.
Yeah, please,
that
yeah.
was no one in the world appreciates how difficult rowing is. I'm going to say that again. No one in the world, if I were good at rowing, I'd wear a t-shirt every day saying, ask me how hard rowing is. It is so difficult. I'm a boat person. I'm a water person. My wife and I used to belong to a club with sliding seat, overlapping, sculling oars, but in a proper boat, in a Whitehall. When you get in a shell, a boat that's as wide as your hips and 5 inches off the water, you can fall in right now. It is so hard. And it's all about balance. And I was very cocky about it. I thought when they called and said, production approved you for 4 lessons with some Olympian down in Long Beach, I was like, be surprised if it takes me 4, but that sounds cool. And the 30 seconds in the boat, I was like, I'm going to need a lot more lessons than 4 lessons.
So, I mean, that just adds to your character. I mean, now, was that a mutual decision behind yourself and creative? Like, hey, this is going to just step it up, that we're not just going to put in green screen of erging for all of our talent. No, no, you're actually going to get in the boat. You're actually going to do the work.
I think that was a decision made by the creative powers that be long ago, and I think it's a good one, but it's an expensive one. It's one that involved weeks and weeks of lessons for Bree and for Lewis and for me. And then on the shoot day, it involves chase boats and, you know, rescue swimmers on jet skis and getting, they had to source 1950s, 1960s wooden rowing shells. When the show got announced, somebody from the Long Beach Rowing Center drove up to Seattle to go put one on a trailer. And I think they got one off the wall of a TGI Fridays, in fact, because it was like era appropriate and they're hard to find these days because they're made of wood and are very, very precarious. When you get in these boats, this is one of the first indications of how difficult this is. They say there's only one place on the boat that you can step. Otherwise, you'll put your foot through the hull and the boat will sink. Yeah, they're made of nothing. They're super light. Yeah, it's nobody knows how hard rowing is.
All right, bringing it back to supper at 6. Which food would you like to cook and eat from supper at 6? And even any food featured in Lessons in Chemistry?
You mentioned the lasagna, and that looked amazing to me. Although I would say, I think that Mad's lunches that Bree sent her daughter to school with, gourmet sandwiches and such. And of course, kids being kids, she traded it away immediately. But those lunches look spectacular to me. Those look like the exact type of thing that you'd want to, you know, have on the road or be able to take to work.
I certainly did not have those school lunches growing up.
Pizza and fries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What is your dream cooking show where you're the host? So say...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so say like a studio or a network is like, Mark, we love you. We love your work, but... we want you to be the host of a cooking show, but you have full creative control, any budget. Floor is yours.
I love this idea so much. I just started following a Japanese man on Instagram who makes, he's got these kits, these aluminum camping kits, and it's like campaign furniture. And he opens this box and out come cutting boards and a little stove and tea sets and coffee sets and oil lamps and stuff. And it's the most romantic thing in the world. I'll show you a link before I leave. And so my cooking show would be, you hike up a hill to a scenic overlook and then prepare things like tiny luxuries prepared in the wild, with a fantastic vista. So this could be, I mean, my thing would be, I wish my whole life were a lobster bake. Like I would love to just boil lobsters and corn and potatoes and cook, you know, snails and mussels and steamer clams and then finish it off with s'mores. That's my restaurant. It's a camping. You are up a mountain and you are doing a lobster bake and there are s'mores.
With some ice cold suds?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, brown liquor to finish it off.
Can I bring the sausage? Can we throw in some sausage in the,
by all
the
means,
bake?
Of course.
And what about some crawfish?
I'm in. Absolutely. Nice. Yeah, more is more.
I love that. You played a role in The Good Place. You actually played a role, in The Bad Place from the show The Good Place.
Correct.
Speaking of fictitious and you're going off of fictitious dining experiences, how would you design a dining experience that embodies The Bad Place?
Oh, gosh. Well, that gets filthy immediately. I mean, at best, it starts with acids and shards of glass, and then immediately becomes full diarrhea. Nobody wants to hear me answer that question.
Fine, what about this one? When viewers saw you in The Bad Place, there was a lot of like, didn't see it say, but heard it, like the torture and, you know, and your the torture and just evil stuff. Well, in terms of food, and you can speak now as an adult or when you were a child, what food or dish was considered torturous to you to where you were in The Bad Place?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and we still bewilderingly drank milk, like with meals, like filled a glass with milk and drank it, which now seems disgusting to me. And my parents, my father grew up during the Depression, so my torture, the thing that was the most punitive was like you'd have dinner, and maybe having had half of your milk, they'd be like, finish that milk. But this time it's warm, it's room temperature. And that is gross. And I would be made to finish my milk and not waste it. And that was arduous. Like, that was the grossest. Yeah. I may have to leave to briefly vomit.
Sorry for triggering a memory. Sorry for triggering a memory. Yeah.
I'll work through it.
Right. And, you know, one of the cool things about the funny things, there was many funny things, but one of the funny things was all of the puns that were used in all of the fictitious restaurants, you know, especially the frozen yogurt. Now, in reality, there are puns for restaurants all over, especially Vietnamese restaurants. Like, there's pho king, you know, there's pho nominal, et cetera, et cetera. What about a pun makes a restaurant more enticing? So if you're driving, you're like, that's funny. You're with your wife. That's funny. Let's just eat there. Yeah.
I'm the opposite. I hate puns so much. they make me angry. And I think they only worked in The Good Place because Megan Amram, the primary writer of the puns of Footlogger and Biscotti Pippin and Pump Up the Clam and A Little Bit Chowder Now and all of them. She just was so relentless with the puns and such a deep well. Like, she took something that I think is pedestrian and like low and just made it exquisite. Like, she perfected the restaurant pun kind of thing. When I see a hair salon called like Sheer Madness or whatever, like, everything in me wants to burn that place to the ground. But Megan Amram in particular made those puns really good. I shot a movie in Vietnam, and pho for breakfast is how you do it. Like, my wife and I were in Vietnam for a few weeks, like 2016, I think, on this film, and they eat pho for breakfast. And at first it was like, oh, I don't know if I want like noodle soup for breakfast. And then you realize, like, oh, this is great. Like, this is a perfect, it's light, it's a perfect balance, it's a little bit of carb, a little bit of protein. And when we got back to Los Angeles, we were like, a few days later, we were like, what time's that pho place open? Like, if they're open at 10:30, I might go there for breakfast kind of thing. I recommend pho for breakfast.
Mark is speaking the gospel, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
You heard,
right. I mean, we were in Hanoi, my wife and I. Yes, pho for breakfast is no joke. Now, did you have the Chinese donuts with the pho? They sometimes put some.
No.
It's almost like a chu cho, Chinese Vietnamese fusion, or it's more of the Chinese influence of Vietnamese food, and they put these Chinese donuts in the pho, in the beef pho.
Now I have to go back. No, I don't think I did.
Oh yeah, and also, really quick, if you want pho in the morning, you do have to take a trek. Yes, right now we're in Los Angeles, but you do have to take a 45-minute trek to Little Saigon in Orange County.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and also, you want to go where all the gangsters go. I'm just saying, in the morning with all of their, you know, let's just say crew, if you will, but you know it's going to be good.
Oh, I'll check it out.
All right, so a little bit more of, well, just food in general. You know, you mentioned this movie you shot. You mentioned, you know, King Kong or the Skull Island. Mm-hmm. Let's even throw in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and even let's throw in all the other shows and films you remember. Which one had the best food? The actual...
Oh, for us? The catering and craft service?
Yeah.
That's going to be tough. They're all very good. Mm-hmm. We are treated very nicely. The craft service table on any given proper show is like a free convenience store that you can eat from at all times. I think my favorite of those was The Good Place, because Kristen Bell is health conscious and a vegetarian. And so a lot of the snacks weren't, we still had Nerds Ropes and stuff, but a lot of it was like healthier, good for you stuff. I think that I have a weird thing about, I definitely have on set things that I eat that I would never eat in real life. And for me, it's like gummy stuff. I like those Welch's gummy bears and the Haribo. And for some reason, that texture on set. I mostly eat in the morning so that my stomach doesn't growl on camera. Kristen Bell's sets have a very good craft service. I mean, all of it's amazing.
Just really quick, I mean, has that actually happened to you or one of your co-stars where... you'll be doing a scene and then suddenly like they're hungry and you hear a gurgle or no?
It just happened to me just now.
Oh.
I'll find it. For sure. Like, yeah. I mean, when you're, you know, when you've got Sennheiser 416s and stuff, like it's going to pick it up, and we're wearing microphones in our clothing. Like, yeah, it's going to get you a good like for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You help a lot of the improv community, especially in Detroit and all that. Now, to an up-and-coming improv actor, instead of coming up to you and saying, hey, Mark, what advice would you give me? What advice would you tell an emerging up-and-comer to ignore?
I think the advice I would recommend ignoring is to be versatile. Like, I think that... versatility can come later. I think that you should find what you do, what your comedic voice is, who you are as a performer, and distill that rather than go, and I should learn to juggle, and I should ride a unicycle, and I should learn to row, and do a bunch of accents. I recommend that that you find your comedic voice. What's the way that you would do the scene that nobody else can or would, because they just aren't you? Distill who you are as a performer and perfect that, and then begin to spiral outward.
How did you find your voice?
I found my voice through improv. I've never studied acting. I've never taken an acting class. I found improv accidentally in the mid-90s in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Some friends of mine from college were putting together a short-form improv troupe to play games, kind of like Whose Line Is It Anyway? And I grew up playing a lot of music. So they asked my college roommate to come play piano for them. And he said, I don't want to do that. You go do that. And I went to the first rehearsal to go be the accompanist for River City Improv and saw what they were doing and was like, holy cow, we need to find somebody else to come play the piano because I want to learn to do what you're doing and do it for the rest of my life. Like, it was a gigantic aha moment for me. And then just by doing it and doing it and doing it, like... improv is the greatest, and everyone should take an improv class, whether you have any hope of ever being a performer or not. Like, it's such a world-opening, fear-erasing, empathy-driving skill set. That's why my wife and I, 12 years ago, launched the Detroit Creativity Project, a 501c3 nonprofit, to teach improv free of charge in Detroit middle and high schools, because it's the best thing for everybody. Like, it's such a collaborative... It gives you a sense of belonging. You learn teamwork and listening and respect. And you learn that you're improvising at every moment. We're improvising now. There's no script for what we're doing now. There's no script for how anybody goes through their day. So for me as an actor, like, it was just doing it and doing it and doing it and finding what I found funny, what tickled me, and you know, the delivery of a line or the status of a character, choices like that. It's improv 100% that is how I found my comedic voice.
And either, say, with with the roles you choose, or just as a fan, as a watcher, yeah, what types of stories stick with you?
My stomach just growled and I missed it. I've been very fortunate. Like I've been able to work a lot. So I am now able to be a little bit choosy when it comes to roles. There are definitely things that it's like, I don't like taking a role that I read and think like, well, anybody could do this. Like I like seeing a role and it's like, oh, this is meant for me. Like this is a thing that I can really sink my teeth into and make mine, kind of thing. But early in your career, you take jobs, you take the whatever jobs you're given. The things I like saying the bold untruth. I like playing characters who are so wrong, like a Sean from The Good Place. Like, that's a fun role to play because he's wrong all the time. He is the worst. And, to know that the rest of the characters and story around you is going to correct you. That's a dumb guy with a big ego that I love to be.
What failure of yours has actually turned out to be a success or an ultimate success? So say at the time you are really pissed like that this didn't happen or this didn't go well, but now looking back, it's like, no, it needed to happen because it opened so many doors. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is that way for me. I tested for the role of Charles Boyle. I tested for Joe Latrullio's role. It came down to him and me, and we did chemistry reads with Stephanie Beatrice because they had sort of a will they, won't they in the first season, and did chemistry reads with Andy Samberg, improvised with Andy to see what that would be like. And I wasn't pissed about not getting it. It came down to the two of us, and the role was written the way Joe played it. Boyle was a kind of a schlub, and I can't be a schlub. Like I approach everything as me, which is Niles Crane, C-3PO, I went about it that way, but I improvised a lot and they kept bringing me back because they're like, he's totally wrong for this, but it's very fun and very weird. And so it came down to the two of us, and Joe, I had known a little bit before then, and we were in a green room, you know, for our final tests, and both, you know, we shook hands and hugged and we're like, however this goes, it goes. And I went and I killed in my final audition and got in the car and called my manager and said, like, I did everything I wanted to do. If we get this, great. If we don't, no harm, no foul. Joe's going to be great at it. But, you know, obviously it's a network television job. It was a job that I wanted. And so you do leave it going like, you know, I feel fine. I did everything I wanted to do. It was, he's doing it as written, you know, and he's improvising as well, but he's closer to the character. And that makes a lot of sense. But like, it does hurt your heart where you're like, oh, like so close to this really cool show. Andy Samberg and Andre Brower and Terry Crews, like what an amazing show. And that opened so many doors because the producers of that were the producers of Parks and Rec. And so a couple weeks later, my phone rang and my agents were like, they want you for Parks and Rec next week. And I was like, I didn't audition for Parks and Rec recently. They're like, I don't know. And they gave me a role on Parks and Rec of Trevor Nelson, the lawyer from Four Dips, Winchers, Grit, Peppa, Pacoda, Vorp, and Eckstein. And I played that role for the next however many years, whenever they needed an attorney. The directors of the pilot of Brooklyn Nine-Nine are Phil Lord and Chris Miller. So I got 22 Jump Street from that. And then, of course, a couple of months later, I got an email saying they'd like to offer you the role of Dr. Kevin Costner, husband to Captain Raymond Holt. And I can remember sitting at my desk in my office and screaming. Like, I called for my wife. I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. Like it opened so many doors. And I was bummed, you know, like I really wanted to do it. And it turned out I did. Like it came around in a different and better for me way.
Mark, what question are we not asking?
Why should everyone take an improv class? I'm glad you asked. It's good for everybody. No jokes. It's so much fun. You'll make the best friends of your life. When you learn to be vulnerable in front of other people, you realize it's not that scary. And look up your local improv classes and go take one.
Mark, thank you, thank you, thank you. You are welcome back anytime. Obviously, you're welcome back in studio, but if you just want to erg and row a little bit while I get my surfboard, that is, well, obviously, the ocean's right behind me, so let's hit it, let's kick it. And anyway, thank you for watching us. Thank you for listening to us. You want to know all things Mark Evan Jackson? He's out there. Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Lessons in Chemistry, The Good Place to name just. That's just the tip of the iceberg of all the creative projects he does or has done. Look for him in future projects. My name is Monis Rose. You found us wherever you watch your podcast, wherever you listen to your podcast. And as always, keep it real, keep it fresh, and keep on the flip side.